Greetings, friends. This is the first of two Dhamma talks on the wisdom of developing restraint. This talk includes Sangha Q&A and discussion, and it was recorded at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on November 1st, 2016. This talk concludes with Metta Intentional Meditation. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's talk is on the wisdom of restraint. It's a long article. Like I said, I'll teach it in two parts. It cites four different suttas where the Buddha teaches restraint in four different applications. And this really is the heart of the Buddha's teachings. And it's restraint in thought, word, and deed, but ultimately it's learning to gain control of our thinking. You remember from the Vatthakasanthana Sutta, the Buddha says to think what you want to think when you want to think it. That's the essence of restraint. We have gained the ability to restrain our thoughts rather than have our thoughts run wild, which is what a self-referential ego self needs to continue to establish itself in everything that's occurring. If there's any questions while I'm reading this, please just ask, and we'll have a comment and discussion after we're done, after we go around the room. The wisdom of restraint. There is a popular phrase that shows that the modern view of the purpose of life for many is acquisition and a consumer way of life. And there's a quote that probably most of you have heard. Life is a banquet, don't leave the table hungry. That's become a creed for many people, the way they live their life. This phrase is likely an adaptation of a quote from Aristotle, who lived approximately 150 years after the Buddha. And his quote was, "It is best to rise from life as from a banquet, neither thirsty nor drunken." Notice the middle way that Aristotle was talking about. Take what you need. Notice how the adaptation to Aristotle's quote dismisses restraint in favor of consumption and continually seeking to satisfy the senses. Rephrasing the modern adaptation to reflect restraint might be, life is a banquet, take only what is necessary. Modern life encourages constant engagement with the world and in many subtle ways discourages restraint. In fact, you can say that restraint is antithetical to the way we're almost taught to live our lives. We should just always be chasing after something and gaining things to add to this thing we call a self. Many today feel overwhelmed by the demands of life and the busyness of their lives. Often what is creating the busyness is a lack of restraint and a wrong view of what is realistically skillful and necessary to associate with. Solitude and disengagement are essential aspects of the Dhamma and are easily developed through proper restraint. In fact, that's kind of the essence, that developing a place and a time for solitude and disengagement from the world. Of course, we do that every time that we meditate, but we should start learning to take that off our cushions and let that be a reflection of our developing restraint, how we live a much simpler life. It is mindful restraint at the sixth sense base. Everybody knows what the sixth sense base is? I think I've talked about it enough. Our five physical senses and that sixth sense are ongoing consciousness. But remember, it's not consciousness with a big C. It's ongoing consciousness that's rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. Nothing grand about it. It is mindful restraint at the sixth sense base that develops awakening or full human maturity. The sixth sense base is our five physical senses and interpretive thinking. In this way, the teachings on restraint directly relate to dependent origination in a very practical way. And just to review that, I know we talk about this a lot too. Dependent origination shows that from ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, as a requisite condition, come fabrications. From fabrications, as a requisite condition, come consciousness. A few people have asked me in the last few days a little bit clearer definition of fabrications, and the best one word is assumptions. So something happens to us and our thinking is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and so we start creating assumptions about what we want out of life and what life is like and what we are in relation to that life, fabrication. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. Remember, that ongoing consciousness is rooted in thinking and ignorance. There's nothing cosmic or universal about it. It's just an ignorant train of thought. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. From name and form as a requisite condition comes the sixth sense base. So now you see how this is starting to fit into that. From the sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes contact. From contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. So now you see how that initial ignorance through that next step or next link of assumptions now leads us to have assumptions when we're in contact with the world. Is that clear how that process is taking place? And this is not something that... it's linear in the process, but internally it happens in the blink of an eye. Unless we develop very deep and profound concentration, we have a hard time actually seeing that process take place one step after another. But it's enough to just to understand that it's taking place. And every time we engage with the outer world through our senses, we're building on those false assumptions, unless we have another frame of reference in which to change those assumptions. And that's exactly why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. In fact, you could say it's really the only reason. I'm going to go back one. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. And so now this is a lot of times dependent origination is taught as a creation myth, and the Buddha's teaching how the entire cosmos, all of creation, came into being, and he was never concerned about this. What he's talking about in this becoming is giving birth to another moment that's rooted in ignorance and can only produce further confusion, delusion, and suffering. Or, as we develop the Eightfold Path, we can now give birth, a rebirth, to a mind and a state of mindfulness that's inclined towards awakening. It's the potential that each moment holds. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow. From becoming, as a requisite condition, comes birth. So, the Buddha states it very clearly. We have to have, if we're going to give birth to a moment that is prone to confusion, delusion, and further suffering, it has to be rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, which is why for his entire 45-year teaching career, everything he taught relates to the Four Noble Truths, so we can develop wisdom where there was once ignorance. And that's pointing to the wisdom of restraint. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. From birth as a requisite condition comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. And again, this is simply part of the First Noble Truth, what I just read there. It's part of living a human life. We are going to have these experiences. What restraint develops is a lack of reaction to these things that naturally occur in life. We remain at peace as sickness, aging, death, regret, being separated from what we want, being with something or associating with what we don't want. All of those normally cause a reaction to a mind that's rooted in ignorance. As we develop wisdom and restraint, we no longer react. And we live lives of ongoing peace and happiness, which is what everyone wants. We just don't know how to get it yet. As the fifth link in the 12-link chain of dependencies, the sixth sense base follows from the initial ignorance of Four Noble Truths. What this means is that the interpretation of contact at the senses is rooted in ignorance, and any further assumptions made by contact can only further the confusion and deluded thinking that was initiated by initial fabrications arising from ignorance. I probably should have made that three or four sentences, but I didn't. In other words, whatever follows from ignorance will be tainted by the fabrications or conditioned thinking initiated from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It is imperative to recognize the ongoing process of using sensory stimulus to attempt to continue to establish a permanent self through discursive self-referential thinking. Rather than use sensory stimulus to continue confusion, delusion, and ongoing unsatisfactory experiences, recognizing this process of I-making or selfing develops the ability to be mindfully present with whatever is occurring, rather than interpret life unfolding from a view rooted in initial ignorance. Is that clear, or relatively so? No questions about where I've gone so far?
It's very condensed, the one that I found, those two paragraphs that you just read.
Yeah, I think
I'm... condensed.
Yeah.
I can't really get them from the...
I don't know that I do.
I think you should read it again.
Yeah. hopefully by the end of... by the end of these two classes, it'll become... Yeah, I will.
Well, you did say I should have made two or three sentences.
At least.
Instead of one.
maybe two or three articles out of that one sentence. I will cite four suttas that teach restraint. Each sutta teaches restraint. I should restraint in sentence structure. In the Aparahani Sutta, restraint is presented as a guard against losing the Eightfold Path. So these four suttas, I only read two tonight, and the other two you have to come back on Saturday, are the Buddha's teachings on restraint in four different applications. And from what I can gather, you can't. It's very hard to say, to understand in the time frame of those 45 years that the Buddha was teaching, where he taught these in that time frame. But just from some of the verbiage, it looks like these were pretty well spread out over the 45 years. But again, that's kind of speculation on my part. The Aparahani Sutta, not losing the way. The Buddha teaches those gathered. Having developed four qualities, a Dhamma practitioner cannot lose the way and is free of clinging to views. When one has fully integrated the Eightfold Path, they are established in virtue. They guard the sixth sense base. They know moderation in eating, and they are devoted to mindfulness. And how does one establish virtue? They are continually mindful of the precepts and the various factors of the Eightfold Path. They understand even the slightest unskillful actions. And how does one guard the sixth sense base? On seeing form, they do not grasp at fabrication. That would further greed and distraction. They practice restraint at the eye. Everyone knows what that means?
No.
So, thank you. So, we become enamored with things, obviously, through our senses. And so something catches our eye. I always use the chocolate cake as a good example. A nice whole chocolate cake sitting on the counter, and I happen to see it. My next thought was, I want at least one piece, and probably two, and maybe three. Contact at the eye set that in place. Now, if I had restraint, I would notice a chocolate cake and say, maybe I'll have a piece. But I'm just going to have one. And I'm being a little silly. What I'm trying to point out is from eye contact, my thought process is restraint, so it doesn't lead to craving, clinging, and needing one or two or three or four chocolate cakes. It's just a chocolate cake. Nothing arises from it. And we can do that with anything. Does that answer your question? And we do this with all the senses. So the Buddha continues. Furthermore, on hearing a sound, they practice restraint at the ear. On smelling an aroma, they practice restraint at the nose. On tasting a flavor, they practice restraint at the tongue. On feeling a tactile sensation, they practice restraint at the body. So where's the Buddha teaching restraint?
At all five.
And at the only place that we can practice restraint, isn't it? Because we lose restraint through contact with the outside world. We see the chocolate cake or a nice apple pie or a brand new Ferrari or a pretty girl or a pretty boy or a nice dog.
Or
on and on and on. And we create attachment and craving for more of it. You all heard my story about the green flash in Hawaii, the sunset. We do this with everything, and the reason why we do it with everything is because our thinking is unrestrained. Remember, a self-referential ego personality must establish itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs, or it feels restrained, and a self-referential ego self does not want to be restrained in any way. It needs to continue to establish itself if it's going to continue its dominance over the way we live our lives. Getting to the sixth sense. On cognizing an idea, they practice restraint at the intellect. They do not grasp at fabrications. And we don't become enamored with our thinking. And that really is the problem. We're so enamored with our own thought processes that we even resist looking at that one, that simple thing. How are we thinking? And what's the result of that thinking? I'm going to read that again. On cognizing an idea, they practice restraint at the intellect. They do not grasp at fabrications. Or in assumptions. I assume that one whole chocolate cake would do me some good. It's an assumption. It's a fabrication. This is how one guards the doors to the sixth sense base. And how does one establish moderation in eating? They understand nourishment skillfully. They do not eat for entertainment or distraction. They do not eat for intoxication. They do not eat to grow large or for beautification. I like that line. They eat simply for the survival of the body, so that the integrated life can be lived. We have to take care of ourselves so we can develop the Dhamma. It's skillful to take care of your physical body, but not to the point that we're doing it because we're concerned how other people might see us. The skillful intention is so that we're simply healthy enough to develop the Dhamma. And the more unhealthy we are, the more difficult it's going to be to simply practice the Dhamma. More, you had a question?
Was in the sutta in order to live the integrated Dhamma? Was that what you read?
No, the translation, Thanissara's translation was in order to live the holy life. But the holy life has some implications that today I don't think really relates to what the Buddha meant as a holy life. Holy life means a life that is wholly integrated. So that's why I use those words.
Quite integrated in there.
Yeah.
See, I caught it. I was awake.
Good for you.
That didn't sound like the Buddha's words, but it's a very good word.
It is.
I mean, it's a very effective word. Let's put it that way.
Thank you. They eat simply for the survival of the body so that the integrated life can be lived. They abandon craving for food and for mindless eating. Something else I've observed. And how does one establish mindfulness as a quality? Whether resting, sitting, or moving about, they cleanse their mind of anything that is a distraction. This is how one establishes mindfulness. Having established these four qualities, this Dhamma practitioner, so since you asked, the translation doesn't say Dhamma practitioner, it says monks. And since none of us are monks, but we are Dhamma practitioners, I thought that was a more inclusive phrase.
Integrated.
And it was a very well integrated phrase.
Effectively integrated.
Having established these four qualities, the Dhamma practitioner will not lose the Eightfold Path. Remember, this sutta was about how not to lose the path. You integrate these four qualities. The Buddha continues, established in virtue, restrained with the sixth sense base, established in moderate eating, established in mindfulness, forthright and inspired, the qualities for unbinding develop. Delighting in refined mindfulness, knowing the danger of mindlessness, they stay true to the Eightfold Path and remain free of deluded views. Not bad, huh? That's that sutta. So in this sutta, the Buddha teaches the importance to develop the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path of right speech, right action, and right livelihood, to recognize and abandon unskillful thoughts, words, and deeds. The concentration developed through shamatha vipassana meditation supports the refined mindfulness that brings the ability to guard the sixth sense base. Excuse me. In the Bhikkhu Vagga Sutta, Bhikkhu Vagga means to the monk. In the Bhikkhu Vagga discourse, the Buddha continues the theme of restraint and also addresses the three defilements of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. The Bhikkhu Vagga is from a section of the Dhammapada, which is a collection of short texts from the Kadaka Nikaya. The only reason I say that, this is not technically a standalone sutta. The Dhammapada is simply written as one long verse, but it's usually separated into different sections, and this section is called the Bhikkhu Vagga.
Real quick, the Dhammapada is a section of the...
Yes, the Kudaka Nikaya, which is the fifth book of the five books of the Pali Canon. So it's a section in that collection.
And it's much more poetic in telling.
Yes, it's
the discourses.
Yes, but there's other discourses that use prose and verse interchangeably too. But the Dhammapada is verse, and it's a very useful book to study because it's very concise teaching. So you can read a couple of lines in it and you understand what the... So this is a section. You'll see what the Dhammapada is like. The Buddha teaches restraint at creating a Dhamma diminished by rites and rituals. He further teaches restraint at attempting to establish a self in non-physical realms, something that is very prevalent in modern Buddhism, isn't it? Here the Buddha is painting a picture of an awakened, fully mature human being living a life of peace and happiness, free of entanglements with the world. The Bhikkhu Vagga. The Buddha's words, skillful is restraint at the eye, at the ear, at the nose, and at the tongue. Skillful is restraint at the body. Skillful is restraint in speech. Skillful is restraint in thought. Restraint in all experiences is skillful. One restrained in the world is free from confusion, delusion, and disappointment. Those who have full control over their hands, their feet, and their tongue, how practical and direct this teaching is. And it makes some people laugh. Those who have full control over their hands, their feet, and do you got control of your feet, Maura?
Never, I did twice the other day.
Those who have full control over their hands, their feet, and their tongue are delighted with their understanding. So nothing lost there, huh? I bet you that word restraint has an initial reaction to almost every one of us. We don't like to hear it, do we? But it's good. They are well established in meditative absorption. Remember the talk on the jhanas. Again, the Buddha is pointing to meditative absorption as it's no big deal, but it's the most important thing. They are content in solitude, free of entanglements. They are called Dhamma practitioners. The Buddha's words were monks. But. Those who have control of their tongue are moderate in speech. Unassuming, they explain the Dhamma with integrity and by example. Their words are useful and pleasing. So he's also implying that you got no business teaching the Dhamma until you have a little bit of restraint. Because how else can you teach the Dhamma if it's rooted in restraint unless you've developed a certain amount of restraint? Restraint at the tongue. Those that abide in the Dhamma, who delight in the Dhamma, are mindful of the Dhamma, they do not lose the Dhamma. Those free of aversion of what has occurred to them and free of craving for what has occurred to others will be able to attain meditative absorption. Those that are calm even when receiving little, pure in livelihood and determined in their Dhamma practice, are exalted by the wise. Those that are calm, even those with no clinging to thoughts or feelings, free of regret from what is not present, they are true Dhamma practitioners. Those who abide with compassion for all beings and devoted to the Dhamma will achieve unbinding and the bliss of the cessation of all conditioned thinking. Empty of all conditioned thoughts, free of craving and aversion, they achieve unbinding. Abandon the five lower fetters of self-referential views, of doubt, of belief in rites and rituals, of lust and of ill will. Abandon conceit, restlessness, and ignorance, and abandon the fetters of craving to establish a self in heavenly realms or formless realms. So that's often taught, especially in the more mystical applications of modern Buddhism, appeasing and attaining heavenly realms and other favorable non-physical realms is taught as part of the goal of the Dhamma, to create future rebirths in favorable places. When the Buddha teaches, any type of rebirth is prone to confusion, delusion, and suffering, no matter what realm you're in, physical or otherwise. Cultivate the skillful faculties of conviction, persistence, refined mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Overcoming the fetters, one has crossed to the far shore of lasting peace and happiness. Develop concentration through meditation. Do not be heedless and allow your mind to be distracted by sensual pleasure. The world's bait is like a red-hot ball of iron. Do not swallow it and then cry how painful it is. Here's an awakened human being, 2,600 years ago, using a line that is just as impactful now as it was then. Everybody gets that. The world's bait, like a red-hot ball of iron.
Well, and then complain about it.
There's a lot
of references in there to, you know, resistance to what's occurring.
Yeah.
You know, arguing about it or complaining for days on end like I did. Yeah.
When you did it, you swallowed it. There, the Buddha continues, there is no concentration for those that fail to develop insight. Isn't that an interesting line? You cannot develop insight. You cannot deepen your concentration unless it's focused and used as a foundation for deepening insight. Now,
can you just read that line one more time?
Sure. There is no concentration for those that fail to develop insight into impermanence, not-self, and disappointment, the three marks of existence. There is no insight for those that fail to develop concentration. Mm-hmm. If you're going to have one, you got to have both. And remember, it's not some cosmic analytical type of insight into what constitutes a grape. It has to do with insight into the three marks of existence. Anything else is really just a distraction. It's the environment that we live in, and it's the misunderstanding of a self that causes all the problems in the world. So of course, it's insight into those three things that is most important, and that's rooted in concentration. It's developed through Samatha Vipassana meditation. Those who have developed through the Eightfold Path concentration and insight in tandem are close to Nibbana. They're right there. Remember that there's a few teachings I gave on the importance of Samatha Vipassana in tandem, how they were taught by the Buddha as two sides of the same coin, as necessary for developing Dhamma practice. And so there's some modern practices that mostly focus on insight, and they get into very long periods of meditation trying to develop this analytical insight of what's occurring in your mind. Well, without the framework of the Eightfold Path, you're likely to get just distracted within the workings of your mind. Why the Buddha didn't just teach that. Those who abide in solitude, free of worldly entanglements, with a calm mind, who understand the Dhamma through tranquility and insight, Samatha Vipassana, in them arises delight that transcends all human delight. And the Buddha's putting some emphasis on developing delight in our practice, rather than something we're doing grudgingly or because we think we should do it. We do it because it leads to true liberation and freedom. Those that see with true insight the rise and fall of all conditioned things and of the five clinging aggregates, they are full of joy and lasting happiness. This is called the deathless state, as there will be no rebirth of confusion, delusion, and disappointment. We've brought confusion, delusion, and ongoing suffering to cessation, to its final death. That's the true deathless state that the Buddha always refers to. It's not physical death. You know, it's simply death of conditioned thinking by developing the wisdom of restraint, to know how to apply these things. The task of unbinding has been accomplished. Restraint of the senses, contentment in the Dhamma, and restraint of unskillful behavior, these form the foundation of a well-integrated life, of a holy life. Associate with those who are engaged in the noble search, who have passion for the true Dhamma, who are pure in thought, word, and deed, who are pleasant and refined in their behavior, full of joy, unbinding will occur. Just as a jasmine creeper sheds its withered flowers, so should you shed greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. Those well-composed, calm and pleasant in thought, word, and deed, free of worldly entanglements, can be truly known as serene. It is by self-understanding that one can scrutinize themselves and restrain themselves. With the sixth sense base well guarded, with refined mindfulness, one will always live in peace and happiness. So be your own protector. Be your own refuge. What other refuge could there be? Restrain yourself as a rider restrains his horse. Full of joy and conviction in the Dhamma, the peaceful state is developed and conditioned thinking ends. Those that develop the Dhamma illuminate the entire world as a bright moon free of clouds. A nice way to end that sutta. That's the end of the first half. Stay tuned for the second half. Thank you. Before we go around the room, is there any questions related directly to the sutta? No, we're good?
Require several rereadings.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. And again, I'll teach the second half on Saturday, then put the talks together, and that'll be on the website too. And I think I'll probably come back to this sutta itself maybe every couple months, because there's a lot of it.
And we could even just take a few lines from the Dhammapada and sit with that for a little bit.
Frank?
You lost me on banquet. Banquet. I was thirsty or drunk, and I was like back there.
All right, well, let me go back to the beginning. The common belief is that life is about getting as much stuff as you can before it's done.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, I just try to keep it simple. And I understand the reason of the sutras. But for me, I'm still a newcomer understanding this. And I have a pretty sound foundation of the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah.
And the Three Marks of Existence. And the Middle Way. And I know that desires and cravings are okay, as long as I don't attach myself through claiming. And that's kind of like, you know, I have to try to keep the middle way, and I try to do the right view, right intention. Yeah, and it's been pretty good.
Yeah, it is.
When I try to really understand all that, my mind starts spinning.
Yeah, I don't. There's a lot there, you know, and so it's not. It's obviously not meant that I read it or you're going to read the sutta once and you got it. It's really like the Eightfold Path works. The more we look at it and the more we hear these things, the more it becomes part of our practice. Let's go around the room. Matt, good to see you tonight, my friend.
Good to see you, Doug. Good to see everybody here. Really, really good article this week. I think that practicing restraint is just un-American. So it's difficult.
I remember I watched a half hour of the third debate, and I would say, practicing restraint is un-American.
But, you know, that doesn't mean it's not important and fundamental and essential to developing this.
Absolutely.
But there was something in there that I thought was really clear. And just like the idea of rebirth is not about a baby being born into physical form. It's about a moment being inclined towards ignorance or awakening. This idea of the death, of deathless, mm-hmm. being not a physical death, but a moment.
Mm-hmm.
The moment is dead. It's not. It's mm-hmm. not being
mm-hmm.
brought to life through ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And if we don't practice restraint, we're constantly
mm-hmm.
birthing moments through ignorance.
Yep.
And there's nothing but suffering there.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that it was just a very clear, it's very clear.
Yeah.
It's very clear.
Thank you. Okay. Ron, how are you tonight?
Good. I have a great opportunity to practice, to try and practice restraint at the mind. This week we had some high drama at home, and you know, I had to just interfere with two people who were trying to basically kill each other, and I was pretty good at not getting anger, my own anger involved.
Mm-hmm.
But then when it was all over and the state police did not show up, I realized I was in bed and I was trying to get sleep. And I was just astonished how completely out of control my mind was.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to do what I normally do when I get into that state is I try to do some meta. And I mean, it felt like I had to put a crowbar into my head to just pry those thoughts apart and get some space in there.
Yeah.
I could not remember the words.
Wow.
It was, I've heard it, a couple of hundred times. I could not, I had to take it word by word to get in there and just shovel that stuff aside and create some space. And it was, it took half the night to get through that.
Wow.
But it was doable in the end. You know, and then next morning meditation was a little rough, but I was just astonished at the forcefulness of all that.
Yeah.
But there is a way, you know, to restrain even that.
Yeah, and it's remarkable that you're able to recognize it and apply the Dhamma to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it ultimately it works.
It works.
Yeah.
And it's worked before, so
good for you.
We're gonna support.
Good to see you
too.
See you soon. Take care, Drew. Thank you, Frank. Maura.
You had said on Sunday, teachings on restraint, and that's one of your least favorite words or something, or concepts. And I think I used to...
Everybody should know that I was just kidding you.
Yeah. But I think there was true, you know, I felt like that maybe it was renunciation or something that I initially, really argued with, that the term, maybe it was restraint, I don't know. But it was interesting because I didn't, I can remember feeling that way. I can remember my aversion and my resistance, or I can remember the resistance. I can remember the ego's resistance and et cetera to that. I don't consistently have that experience anymore. So that's really something amazing to not consistently. So what I wanted to say about the article and the teaching tonight is it also was interesting that lengthy style that the Buddha teaches and that kind of Frank was referring to, I used to really struggle with it. It was very repetitive and et cetera. So, and tonight, and when I read the article the other day, I really greatly appreciated it from a different, I feel as if my mind is maybe more spacious or more adapted to being able to hear this. And instead of aversion to the length, I find it extremely effective, and that repetitive style. So at the end, Matt, when the deathlessness and the description of restraint and why we have restraint, not from a you should do this because da da da, it pulls you into the experience of really seeing the dangers of following, like you had said, there's only suffering there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was kind of the same at the retreat, like that moment of insight where it just became so clear that all of this just leads to suffering if we don't. So, it's very joyful and it creates a lot of delight to practice. So also the past 2 days or so, you know, I was really looking at restraint a lot and watching the quality of the mind in the very focused practice of restraint and the incredible amount of ease in that mind as opposed to the deluded, grasping, hungry ghost mind. So that's what I have to say on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Katie, it's good to see you. How are you?
Hi, thank you. I'm going to pass.
I'm glad you're here. Hope you join us again. Regina, good to see you tonight. How are you?
I'm okay.
Good.
I'm going to pass too, though, because I'm too new to express any verbiage on this topic.
But that's fine. Your meditation is going well?
Not since Saturday. I've been having a very severe migraine Sunday to Monday, so I'm still kind of recovering.
Oh, yeah. So, well, I'm glad you're here tonight. I'm glad you're here. Keith, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. That was a great talk. There's a lot in there.
Okay.
I read it beforehand, and I listened intently. I'll go back and read it again. There's really a lot to take in.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't have a lot to say about it except for I really appreciate it. And
mm-hmm.
I'll be back on Saturday with some questions, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Good. I'm glad you're, and that, I said to Frank, this is really how the Dhamma works. You know, the very few people hear it once. Kandana did, but most of us don't. And so the only thing you can do is mm-hmm. hear it and do just what you said. Go back to it, look at it. How does it apply to me? How do I integrate these things? But when you look at the Buddha's teaching, they're very practical and directly applied.
Right.
Guard the sixth sense bad. I mean, the essence of it is watch how things come to you and how you react to it. Watch how you're attaching yourselves to things.
Or how you go out to them.
Yeah, you go chase after things. Thank you. Diane, how are you tonight? Good to see you.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you. And thank you for all the work that you put into okay. this. The writing is especially, well, it's, the writing is really good, and I appreciate the work that you've done in putting it in. Mm. in I know you've done some work on it, and I appreciate that.
My writing's gotten a little better, you're saying?
Well, I didn't say
it. I'm just kidding.
See? That's restraint.
That's great.
Days with my son and in-laws, and it was like there was no other mind that I could, other than my grandson, 5 months old, he and I, right on, but everybody else it was like, and so then I've been home like now 2 weeks, and I'm not as courageous as you are. I couldn't fight it in one night. I just, for the last 2 weeks, I've been saying, where did my mind go? Where is it? Where there's something, there was something I had up here, and it's gone. And but then I thought, be gentle. Oh, God, those are the saving grace words. And I thought, okay, I'm not going to fight this. I'm just going to let it be what it is. And I went through the days, and everything, and I thought, gee, I miss myself.
Oh.
Wet, not in a bad, I mean,
yeah. Not in a crazy way.
In an integrated way.
I make it kind of way. Anyway, and that was a discipline in itself,
yeah.
To just let mm-hmm. the time that I had with my family be what it was. And my own recuperative, if it's recuperative, I don't know whether that's a very clever word, Mara, but anyway, it's just really nice to be, what I realized I felt like I was out of my skin for 2 weeks, and I feel like I'm kind of integrating back into it, but it's just really a joy to know that my mind doesn't control me, that I have a say in what's going on, and I can, I mean, the one thing I really started meditating for and praying for both was I didn't feel love, and it's I thought that was kind of weird, but I realize, you know, how you start that with the this world that we live in is consumerism and what's the other word, material, whatever. That's what I lived in the week that I was up there. Is everyone was in consumerism so much, but in doing what Americans do. Whatever that is, and it's just nice to step outside of what Americans do and be, and just be. I don't know whether I'm making any sense of
you
this
are.
Point, but it's just still coming, I'm still coming out of the swamp, so to speak, but it's, this is a the meditation, the Eightfold Path, Four Noble Truths are such a... You can walk around wherever you go saying, you need to know the Four Noble Truths. I'm suffering here, you know, and there's a way out of it. Let me tell you.
don't do that.
What?
Don't do that.
No, I know, but there is... I mean, that's how I restrain myself. Anyway, I'm just thankful to be here and thankful for the work that you do. Thank you.
Thank you. You developed very skillfully the ability to be at peace with less than peaceful mind state. You know, that's another aspect of restraint. Even though my mind is agitated, it just is. It doesn't need to be any different than it is. You understand impermanence, it's going to change. And to be very gentle with yourself. Good for you. Thank you. Bonnie, good to see you.
Nice to see you. So the meditations here are so, I know they're really wonderful because it's just so much more concentrated than all of, I think I also really needed it because of the noisy week I had, and so the, you know, it's like I settle into it, like when you say settle into your seat, settle into your cushion, into your breath and your body. And you say, you know, it's time to come back. And it's like, wow, you know, it's really that I in a way, need to just do more. I mean, I'm always on the mindful thing off of the cushion, and I could benefit more from doing more of it. I do it a lot throughout the day, but anyway, it's just really feels really, really good to stop and how important it is. It's helped me so that with all the noise I can kind of, like you were just saying, just being aware that it is and trying not to be as reactive as I could be. Seeing my own exaggerations and hyperbole, and
so
it's good.
It is. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Lorna, how are you? Was this a little better for you the second time?
Yes, it was. And I was holding in mind what you said earlier about what you're giving up is your conditioned thinking. When you are restraining yourself, and you think you're doing without, and you think that and it's not something we naturally want to do because we're Americans. But
well, some of us are.
You know, you are just giving up your referential thoughts of how life should be, and so I held that in mind when you were talking tonight. And it just goes right through everything.
Yep.
So it made a lot more sense. Yeah. And I wasn't quite so frightened.
Good.
Like I was before when I first read it at home. And I thought, oh my God, you have to do all this watching your Sixth Sense tapes 24/7. Who wants to do that?
Yeah, we don't want 24-hour mindfulness.
Well, and I sort of got on almost a panic with it when I was at home, when I sort of read it at home. And so I even questioned really if I want to go down that road. I told you that,
And now?
This isn't for me, you know. This is more than I want to bite off and chew. It's still a lot to digest. But I wasn't so erratic in my mind listening to it this time. I was following the theme of it a lot better and not so frightened by it, really. Not so frightened. Can I make a little request?
Sure.
I know you put the recording up. Can you put this recording up before Saturday so we can refresh where we are? And
Sure.
So I can listen to this recording.
I'll get it up. I'll get to have it probably before noon tomorrow. I'll have it up.
Oh, okay.
Great. Thank you. So,
who's going to put my sinking?
Oh, it wasn't going to happen tomorrow anyway. The plumber's going to put your sinking. Do I look like a plumber? yes, I'll put it up maybe even tonight or probably by noon before Dhamma stream tomorrow. Ultimately, you mentioned fabrications and assumptions. Ultimately, it is restraining assumptions that, and I look where assumptions or fabrications are in the chain of dependencies. It's the second thing. From ignorance comes fabrication. From ignorance comes assumptions. As we practice restraint at our thoughts and ultimately let go of all fabrications, where are we? We're right where we need to be. We're at wisdom. We've developed wisdom. Wisdom, because we need to develop that. We need to restrain our conditioned assumptions if we're going to actually understand craving and clinging and resulting suffering. And that's how it works. It works in a direct way. It's, again, nothing mystical or esoteric about it. It's a direct assault on craving and clinging, restraint. You know, it's direct approach. Yes. Oh. Yeah, but it scares you sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're, and that feeling that you had when you first came across it, that it was scary, that's something to be acknowledged and, I don't know the right word, and allowed. It's part of it. We're coming up when you, I mean, you really read to the heart of this because it speaks to the essence of the Dhamma and letting go of every self-referential view. That's ultimately what restraint brings us. But it's also not that big of a deal, because what are we letting go of? We're letting go of nothing. The Buddha would often refer to these types of things as like foam on the ocean. It feels like it's so substantial. How can I let go of this one? How can I let go? But there's nothing there behind it. There's no substance behind it. And once we do let go of it, it is just like foam on the ocean. It's no big deal. We realize, why was I holding on to that? It's like carrying a 100-pound block on your shoulder your whole life. Because you think you have to do it, and you're familiar with it. It's just what you do, and you let it go.
But when it's a new idea, you know, it's like stepping out until you're not sure if there's going to be ground underneath.
Yeah.
Until you realize, the earth isn't going to swallow you.
Yes, and that's why the Ratana Sutta is so important, taking refuge, because we understand that there's nothing. Refuge means it's a place of safety and protection, and so we've taken protection, and we feel safe in the Dhamma because we know where it's going. It's not certainly not taking us to a place where there's anything to be afraid of or any pain. It's the end of our own self-induced pain.
Just quick.
Sure.
It seems that this talk on restraint, that restraint is actually the context for the Eightfold Path.
It is.
I mean, that's where the practice of the Eightfold, right speech, right action, right, all of those things are right because they're restrained.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, because they're not grasping. Yeah, it's right because it's restrained.
Yes, and I've been writing this article and doing the research for at least a year. Not that I've worked on it for a year, you know. But one of my thoughts in teaching it was, is this Sangha... I wouldn't teach this in Flemington or Lambertville because it's too far out of context and it's too challenging. But we have developed the Dhamma enough to understand how this applies. We're not talking about annihilation. We're talking about freedom here, you know.
But I think it's not just restraint. You have to have like that... For me, because restraint could also be something about clinging or denying or
aversion.
You know, being
aversion.
Yeah,
yeah,
but that
it has to be in the right context.
Like there's like the first of the Eightfold Path, the view of being able to see what it is, how I need to think about what I say, or what kind of intention do I want to have, even though this is like not what I want to be dealing with, right?
Mm.
So because it is those things that allow me to have the restraint, then I can choose how hard I pull the rein or how much I let it go.
You have to have the right context, or it's not. But that's true about anything. You know, you could take, if you took any one of these sutras out of the context of what the Buddha, out of the context of the Four Noble Truths, it's hard to even apply them. They don't make sense. Diane, you had a question?
No.
Or a comment?
As I realize how much of my consciousness or ego-based conscious thoughts, my conditioned thinking, is based on assumption, and the restraint of, you know, dissolving that, those assumptions, and just being present with what's now, that really opens the door to loving other people, to allowing other people that space. Oh, maybe they're assuming something right now, and I don't have to correct them or fix them or anything like that, but I can just have the openness of my of heart and mind to say, okay, that's where they are, with and without judgment. But if I can't, I mean, that's what practicing that with myself allows me to do with other people.
Yeah.
And that might make me a better person.
Yeah, it will, you know. And it will allow you to be mindfully present with another person when you develop restraint.
Can I add one other thing? Somewhere at the end, it was making me think about it. I've heard many times about the Dhamma that we offer the gift of fearlessness to others, to ourselves and to others. And to me, like, that's a very motivating thing. If I can, and I was reflecting on my week that I did have a lot of aversion, and without judgment, I did not offer, I was not consistently mindful with what was arising, and I was reactive, so without judgment, again, and realizing that if I had, let's just say, I mean, the greatness of the Dhamma is to be able to be with dukkha as it's arising, and to be okay, like people were saying, with it. And to offer that spaciousness and solidity, like, what an incredible gift to ourselves and to the world around us to not be reactive to that which is occurring. So, like, to me, Diane, like, that's where, you know, like, that is so inspiring to me. Like, I want that to occur for myself and others.
Yeah, the Buddha concluded the Bhikkhuvagga Sutta with those words. A true Dhamma practitioner illuminates the entire world.
Yeah, I love that. Beautiful.
Yeah. Very
beautiful. So, yeah, it's a great thing. It's a joyous thing.
It sure is.
It's the best thing we can do for this world and ourselves.
Yep. Andrew, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good evening. I agree with everybody. This was a significant sutta, and it so applies to my lack of restraint, just doing, flitting about. And I intend to read this and hear it a number of times. And that restraint of unrestrained thought and needs to accomplish stuff affects my meditation practice in the morning. But I just came to a realization during the meditation, and I was thinking, trying to get rid of that. All I have to do is, while waiting for my tea to boil, sit down and meditate.
Yeah.
I do that every day. Why not meld the two? So I came into some insight.
Yeah, good for you, Andrew. Yeah, that's another practical application of the Dhamma. You know, we simply, it's almost surprising when we think of things that are so obvious, but they're so valuable too.
And this teaching really flies in the face of Venerable Ray Charles' song that says, when you're dead, you're done, so let the good times roll.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. But, again, that's we're almost taught that we should live our lives that way. Get as much as you can. Have as much as you can. Have as many great experiences as you can. if we spend our whole lives chasing those experiences, we've never really lived our lives, have we? Because we're not present. We're not here with what's occurring. It's always the next thing.
Yeah.
It's always the owner of that restaurant.
Thank
Yeah. Thank you, Andrew. Liz, good to see you tonight.
I'm almost speechless because it's just, it was perfect. I think that several times tonight, the concept of annihilation, you said the word a couple of times, and I think that's something that I cling to because it's been my wandering mind. My wandering mind has been a tool for creative discovery. It's kind of how I operate. The thought of reining that in has left me, Bonnie always says, you know, you lose your mojo. So I feel like I can't grasp what my next project is going to be. I can't, you know, and just with the vitriol of, you know, pre-election garbage, it's been a challenging couple of weeks. I was here on Saturday, but I hadn't been in for a couple of weeks. And desperately needing the refuse. The refuse. Getting rid of the refuse. Anyway.
It wasn't that good of a class on Saturday.
No, Saturday was good.
Oh, okay.
It's. I feel like I have all the pieces to the puzzle, and it will just take that concentrated effort, that focus and discipline of, you know, of the meditation of the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, that will sort of settle everything out. I'm starting to be able to see, you know, I always say I'm going to be the last person to be enlightened because it's just, you know, I have to hear this so many times. Oh, oh, yeah. You know.
Well, you have a good teacher, because
it's simple. But anyway, so I'm just glad I was here tonight to hear what you had to say, and I love that the imagery of swallowing the hot, what was it, the hot metal ball, and then complaining it hurt. Because you know, sometimes you know when we talk about. when we talk about, you know, when Bonnie and I talk about our work and what we're doing, we use the image of, you know, flailing ourselves while you're, you know, trying to create and do stuff, and oh, you know, it's never going to be, you know, the most beautiful object in the world or whatever, and we sort of, you know, so I think the trick is to stop, you know, beating yourself up about a lot of different things. And,
yeah.
And this being one of the most important things too.
Yeah, and I would, not to get into your head, but I would, for myself, I know that the more well structured my thought process is, the more creative I am too, because I'm not distracted. And I can.
I did see a glimpse of that tonight as I was listening, and that maybe the practice of the wandering mind. Opening myself up to it being different.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that a well-concentrated mind is simply well-concentrated in a certain direction, so in a creative direction. I don't know why I was thinking about Maya Angelou, the great writer. It's just such an interesting story. I don't know, I think she does have some Buddhist training, but I'm not quite sure about that. But when she wrote, she would rent a hotel room that was just for her writing. And she would go and do her writing
in the same
town. In the same town.
She would go there every day.
And she insisted they don't ever make the bed because she didn't want the tendency to maybe take a nap. She would only go there and write. Mm-hmm. She created a structure for her, I mean, talk about her creativity. It's incredible. Sure. But she needed that structure in order to do it. Mm-hmm. You know?
The thing is, though, when you live a very productive, creative life, and then you get tired. But if you, like, I know for me, it was like, for for many years I was going, and then I had a transitional part of my life, and I had, and then coming here was incredibly helpful because then I could, it was frightening to be in that place of, you know, that there's that mulching that has to happen, that the ground has to be, you know, after a while, nothing is going to grow, I think, and we have to, so it's also the self-compassion and the kindness to allow myself to be, you know, in, you know, the cruel things I say to myself, or did try, or to be aware that I don't have to do that, and it's a new phenomena also, and that's part of being kind of recognize how hard you work, Liz.
Yeah.
Right? You work really hard, and so that part for allowing my, like, to feel like, you know, that to be able to be silent and allow, and to, which it's a very hard place to be, but I think this teaching makes it, I don't know, it's been a support and a, you know, like a place, a solid place to begin to trust and not be freaking out, because I remember when I first started coming here and some of the things that were said, I felt like I had this image of this cartoon woman running back and forth through the house with her hair on fire, you know. So, but it's that kindness that we to allow ourselves to acknowledge,
not be so busy.
But to also the kindness to acknowledge what you've done and where you've been and where you are now.
Yeah.
And that's the, you know, how hard we are, you know, I have to keep going. And
well, I have, getting back to what Andrew was saying about how he always, you know, flitting around and always, that I had to sort of laugh on the inside when you said, I just have to put the kettle water on and then I can sit, because then you're doing two things at once and you can say, okay, I'm doing two things at once. I can relax. I'm multitasking.
So God forbid the tea, you, because we were, when I did one course, we were just supposed to sit and watch the water boil. Like, and that's really hard because you're not in left mental, you're just supposed to like watch it. But because the mind just wants to be doing something effective.
Making orders.
Andrew, I think it's fine you meditate when your tea is boiling.
I think it's perfectly fine, but I thought, oh my God, that is such a Liz thing. You know, you have to, all right, wait, let me just put a load of laundry in and then I can go meditate. Because, you know, then I'm doing laundry while I'm, you know, or start the tea water or whatever. I just thought.
And that's the American thing that they were talking about, that unless I'm being productive, if, like, to pick up a book and read sometimes, well, like, can I do this? Because how productive am I? You know that we have to, that and that goes back to this artist who, you know, his hands are tired and it's time to rest, and you know, to give that permission that it, that there's something, you know, an American, if I'm,
I know it's getting really late, but I had an 89-year-old woman ask me today if it was okay when she gets up in the middle of the night and goes to the bathroom, when she comes back and she's short of breath, she puts her oxygen on and she feels better. And she asked me if that was okay to do, because she felt like it was kind of weak, like she was trying not to use the oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that is so classically American. I said, you know, so we were talking about how your body is giving you information all the time, but our mind is telling us that we should be doing something else. And, you know, how, anyway, like, it's just so ingrained.
Mm-hmm.
Like, should I really be doing something kind for myself?
And then we need permission.
Putting oxygen on.
And then needing the permission
years old.
To it.
But Moore says it's okay, you know. You can wear it all the time.
Well, but think about the influences that that woman had for 89 years to think that it wasn't okay to do something that brought her comfort. Because it was weak. The you mentioned holy and integrated. The reason why I use the word integrated as opposed to holy is holy has that implication of something special. Holy means whole. And in this case, it means that we're looking at ourselves in our whole experience. In other words, it's not before we came to the Dhamma we were bad or stupid or ignorant. And now we're not. We are what we are. We're in a constant process of becoming. And with restraint, we can become fully mature, awakened human beings. But it doesn't mean that we have to disavow what we once were, meaning a moment ago. And it doesn't mean that we have to disavow what we might be. It means that we have to fully accept in wholeness, with integrity, who we are, right? We're in this present moment. Needing oxygen. Or maybe needing a hug or needing a piece of chocolate cake. But it's all part of being a human being, which is what the Buddha was teaching us. When he got it, what he realizes, we don't know how to be human beings. We don't get it. And here's four truths to show you how to be a human being. There's going to be suffering. Craving and clinging is going to perpetuate it. There's a way out. Develop the Eightfold Path. It's all towards being a whole, well-integrated human being. So, a few announcements. Yes?
I have a question, please. On Saturday, are you going to repeat this class? Or are you going to go to the next section of it?
I don't know. I was thinking I might repeat it, but no. I'm going to go to the second half. And I think I'll probably, you know, there's some suttas that I keep bringing back or some teachings every couple of months. I'll probably do this every couple of months. You know, I think it's an important one. And again, we have, as a Sangha, we have the context to understand it and put it in place. It's not something that we can't use. But there we go. So, yeah, second half coming. I'll put the talk up probably tomorrow. I might even do it tonight. And then when I give the second talk, I'll put them together. Maybe I'll just leave them as two talks then on the website. That might even be a better thing to do. A few announcements. November 22nd, Thursday of Thanksgiving week, is our next Dhana dinner.
Tuesday.
What did I say? Thursday? Thursday. No, it's Tuesday. There's a sign-up list. We'd like some volunteers for setting up and taking down. Moore is coordinating that, but there's a form on the website, on the Dhana dinner page, that you could send to Moore. There's some people that have signed up already.
Yeah.
We're also taking donations.
Do we have a sign-up sheet here?
That's up to the boss.
It's probably easier if you just send it to Moore and keep it. But if you want to help, just come to the Dhana dinner by 5:30 and you can help set up. And if you're there, you can help clean up. So it doesn't need to be that formal. We're taking our Dhana project this year is, there's a basket outside. We're collecting money to give directly to Julie Klein, who owns Love and Oven. This is our seventh dinner there. She's never asked for a penny. And I think it'd be a nice thing if we can send her a couple of bucks. So fill up that basket out there. That's Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. December 4th.
It's like our holiday dinner, and we get to like sit in this great place, in a sense. I was thinking that today, sorry.
December 4th is our next one-day retreat, and the topic, it's a Sunday, the topic is refuge. I think so. Good. Matt's going to be here, Maura will be here. We'll have a couple of teachings. It's going to be a very low-key kind of day. A couple teachings, a couple of meditations. Nope, just show up.
Oh, okay.
10 to 3. Info is on the website, though, the schedule. The following... Oh, we're at a potluck. We're gonna share lunch. So bring something good.
Chocolate cake,
especially. The following week, December 6th, that Tuesday, we're going to start the next Truth of Happiness 10-week course, but it'll probably end up being 12 at least. And this, just like last year, the same class that's on Tuesday will be repeated on Saturday. So if you miss one or there's snow or anything like that, we can stay on schedule. I think that's it. I'm no longer teaching in Lambertville on Thursday nights, but I am teaching in Clinton on Thursday nights now at Hunterdon Wellness Center.
You started this week.
Start this week. That's all on the website. I think that's it. Is there anything else? Okay. Let's finish with the Buddha's words on metta. We always finish a class with metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk today. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of a fully mature, awakened human being. These are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.